This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you guys doing this evening?
Pretty good.
How's it going, good. Nate?
I'm doing great, and it's great to have you guys on again. I wanted to start the show with a comment from one of our listeners. Mm-hmm. So last week you were talking about, staying in a marriage unnecessarily. And the comment was, we want to stay in the marriage for the kids. Mm-hmm. And there was a really wonderful answer from both of you because of that. And one of our listeners wrote a comment on the Facebook group, jokingly said that, "I think Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk missed one reason why people hang in there for longer than necessary. And that's the battle of attrition."
Yeah.
One or both of them are hoping the other meets an unfortunate accident on the way to work, and yeah. Winner takes all in that case.
It's actually true.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness.
All yeah. Right, well. So ain't love grand.
It's a little bit morbid, but with the full moon and the other things going on in the world today, I figured it was a fine comment. All right. Well, let's get to the questions.
Sure.
Dear doctors, and actually, this is a question that came from a listener who really, just loves the show and wanted to ask Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk. Mm-hmm. Would you still recommend psychology as a career? I'm interested in becoming a therapist, and the podcast has turned what I thought I knew on its head, mm-hmm. and it has completely changed the way I would want to go about my theoretical orientation. Mm-hmm. But now that it's so different, I feel like I'm doubting everything. Could you talk a little bit about what it's like to be in the position of the therapist? And I'm looking for information to direct my behavioral output.
I think Jen and I probably will bring subtly different perspectives, just because we have a little bit different, slightly different relationship to people, because me being a male and she being a female, our minds are built somewhat differently. So
differently.
Yeah. our responses to this might be a little bit different. So for me, as we've now learned from work in behavior genetics, that men are typically often very interested in the way systems work. And this, to me, I've been inherently interested in understanding the correct, identifying the system of how psychology works. In other words, what's the nature of motivation? Why does it work the way it works? This is what attracted me to the logic of evolutionary biology. And then from there, I was quickly and easily convinced that evolutionary psychology was the only correct view to understand people or animal motivation, but certainly human motivation, and which is what we're most interested in. And so that from there, we finally had a place to put our lever, and we could develop a system. Essentially, we could understand the nature, and the system we're talking about is the nervous system. So we can understand the nervous system's workings and et cetera. And so from there, we sort of one wave at a time, or one insight at a time, standing on the back of all kinds of giants, we start building an understanding of clinical problems, where they're coming from, and what can and can't be done. And essentially, so this person that's saying, gee, it's turning upside down all my thinking and my theoretical orientation. Well, I would certainly hope so. because the other theoretical orientations are, you know, way behind. You know, they're back in the dark ages before we achieved consilience in this field and wedded clinical psychology and clinical problems to biology, which is where they all come from. So from my standpoint, my sort of way I go about doing therapy doesn't really look anything like typical psychotherapy. Typical psychotherapy is much more naturally, it's got a feel of reparenting to it, because that's what therapists are taught needs to be done. They're taught that essentially the problems that you see in people's adulthood are derived from a sort of haywire processes of their development of their personality as a result of, you know, bad parenting and bad luck and bad things that happened to them, etc. This is all entirely incorrect. And so the problems that you see are either derived from misunderstandings of the environment that can be corrected with correct understanding of the environment, or they're due to personality characteristics that are genetic. And so as a clinical psychologist, it sounds cold. I mean, I'm perfectly friendly, but it's a little bit like a technician's view of the problem. It's very engineering based, and that doesn't mean it can't be inspiring. It can be inspiring when I can remember being quite thrilled when I first used QuickBooks and it balanced a bunch of stuff. It's very exciting. So it's not like
it's very relaxing.
Yeah. So the point is that I could probably be happy working on problems in many complex systems, but I happen to be human oriented and interested. You know, got some little estrogen in there somewhere. And as a result, I can do this, and I really like it. I mean, I think I have a somewhat different, emotional payoff that comes from me than might come from a more traditional therapeutic stance, which is much more interpersonal and connected. So one of the things that I'll have Jen fill us in on her experience in a minute, but. For example, I have never told people to schedule with me again next week and that we're going to work on this over the next several months, or we're going to make a connection and we're going to have weekly sessions. Never. Never in my career did I do that with a single client. Okay? That whole view, which is a very nurturing, reparenting process, is never been part of my repertoire. Never made any sense to me intuitively. My job was to understand where I could put my finger on the dysfunction. And once I put my finger on it, if I felt like it was a personality variance that was not changeable, I would say, I don't think there's anything I can do. And here's what I would do, but that's it. And if I felt like it wasn't a personality disturbance, that it had to do with their understanding of reality and the nature of the competitive problems that they were facing and what they needed to do in order to address those competitive deficits, then we mapped out a plan that made sense to my understanding of the nervous system. And I hoped to stoke excitement in them as they started to see and feel what it would feel like to get control of the adaptive challenge. So that's how I have done it, and none of that has ever looked anything like traditional therapy. So what is it like to be a therapist? I kind of don't know, because that's not, I don't do it the way other people do it. The way I do it is very much somebody that is a software debugger out there would know exactly what this feels like. Because it's, I feel like I'm debugging software, and instead of having a program work, what I have is a nervous system now happier and more effective. So that's what psychotherapy looks like to me. Certainly, there's a human element to it, but that's mostly what it looks like, And if that sounds interesting to you, great. If it doesn't sound interesting to you, we'll listen to Jen and see what her experience is. Okay. Well, go ahead, Jen.
We don't know if this questioner is a systematizer brain or a more relationally oriented brain. So these are the two types of paradigms that more or less correlate with the male brain and the female brain. Although, of course, this is a distribution and there are lots of exceptions and there are women who are much more systematically oriented and men who are much more relationally oriented. But all things equal, men are systematizers and women are relationally, you know, interpersonally oriented. And so I think I come at this, I mean, I'm sort of an accidental therapist. I didn't go into this looking to pursue therapy as a career. I just stumbled into evolutionary psychology, the source code of evolutionary psychology, and had this kind of long-standing interest in helping people solve problems and helping trying to help people clear distortion, which is not quite what I realized I was trying to do. And I was doing it, and I've talked about this before, but just in a lot of confused and misguided ways, including astrology consulting and intuitive consulting and working as a student counselor at colleges and all of these different practices that were not formally therapy, but were, you know, using many of the techniques. And I was picking up a lot of these things along the way. And then you come across the academic information of evolutionary psychology, and it's like, oh, this is suddenly a much more efficient way to go about this, even though I'm coming into the whole exchange with somebody from less of a debugging kind of perspective. And I recognize what Dr. Lyle's saying there, because I've had the same feeling, and I have he's got enough estrogen in there to make him, you know, at least present as friendly enough in the exchange
to mimic some
unconditional positive regard. And I've got just enough testosterone to like understand, like perceive the moment when I've debugged the program and get some joy from that and recognize that's the most important thing that is actually happening in the exchange, rather than the, well, gosh, this has just been such a great talk and let's talk again next week, which I also don't. I've never tried to lure somebody into a recurring kind of relationship, where I think a lot of therapists that are doing that both are coming from a more like purely psychodynamic relational point of view, where they really do want to build a relationship. And if we build trust, then you can tell me more about your childhood damage, and we can peel away the layers of the onion and get to the truth and go through this whole process where we heal your traumas. But a lot of that is financial insecurity and scarcity, and oh, I've got a client, I need to keep them, so I need to lure them back next week, I need to set up a recurring kind of relationship, where I think both Dr. Lyle and I are like in the business of trying to get fired. we're trying to not be needed anymore, like, oh, okay, well, you know, we de-distorted the system one way or another, whether it's through a confrontation with personality limitation or a recognition of where the information was haywire in the system, so people can recalibrate and run a more efficient cost benefit analysis, which is really the whole aim of the whole enterprise. So I think I definitely When you have somebody that you're able to take through a process and find where the big distortion is, and it's a distortion that can be reckoned with in some meaningful way, that's a very satisfying process. But if you are relationally oriented, I guess if you're systematically oriented or relationally oriented, it is equivalently frustrating to run into situations where you can't de-distort the system, usually because of intractable personality cancer. Yeah. And personality issues. So I would say that's the major limitation. If you go into this and you recognize the incredible salience of behavioral genetics in affecting human behavior and just human relationships and everything that you're going to be dealing with as a therapist, and that really is the limitation on the system, and that there's nothing that you, no matter how fantastic a therapist you are, can do about somebody if they really are so distorted at the level of personality that they can't resolve the problem, that's got a sort of inherent frustration to it. So if you're comfortable with that and you're ready to go into it anyway, then it can be very rewarding, for sure, just like any kind of problem-solving enterprise can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, do you find it difficult if you talk to somebody who has distortions that are not solvable to I know whenever I've done programming in my engineering, you know, studies, it was really frustrating when there was something I couldn't debug.
And yeah.
It's just, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very frustrating. And it's, but I think, you know, I know Dr. Lyle has gotten more just with more education in the truth of behavioral genetics, mostly through Robert Plomin, whose book we talk about all the time, Blueprint, and just through increased science in this field. It's you don't blame yourself as a therapist, which is the initial inclination, like, oh, I should be able to solve this, like I should be able to debug this program, where if you really understand what you're up against, and you're looking at major distortion, especially distortion that's interacting with other kinds of personality distortion, it's you don't get in that game where you're taking responsibility for that situation anymore, which is an important place to get to if you're going to stay sane.
Yeah, and what we do when people have personalities that are this is so different. I mean, this is a great question, so we're spending a lot of time on it, but it's an extremely rich question and interesting one. And that is that traditional therapy is totally lost here, folks. Traditional therapy inherently believes that your personality can be changed, specifically with respect to problematic aspects of your personality that they believe were caused by damage. I mean, this is really important to understand how wrong this is, and it is one of the great truths of all time is that now in late 20th century, early 21st century, we found out that personality variation is genetic in origin and not environmental. This is of just immense importance, and in the decades to come, there will be a greater and greater utility and recognition of this fact in everything, in advertising, in job placement, in selection of majors for careers, in, you know, in mating, you know, all of it, like all kinds of decision making. And so and one thing that will ultimately be affected is that 100 years from now, they won't be doing psychotherapy with people that have personality variances that have them on odd places on the bell curve that are causing them to have recurrent struggles in the world. They're not going to be able to try to fix that by going back in their history and then discussing things with them or trying to set up situations that will alter those things because they're not alterable. So this is, you know, this is a hugely transformative realization. It looks from the outside of it. Well, first of all, nobody in the field knows it. Okay, so the average clinical psychologist has no clue that this has been discovered. And so even if they've heard something about it, they're rejecting it and they think it's all a mishmash and it's the old nurture versus nature debate and blah, blah. They don't know anything. They're totally ignorant. Okay, so and therefore they're lost, and therefore their whole model of trying to help people with these types of problems is lost, and it's a total waste of time. Now, I forget where I was going. Now, what I do is when I run into this, what we can do is we try to essentially arrange the person's environment to gerrymander our way around their personality struggles. That's what you do. You don't try to change the individual, for God's sakes. You try to change their environment. And so this is where the way that I will talk about things is so confusing for, you know, if you don't have some horsepower in there and you're not paying attention, the way I talk and the way we talk in this area can be confusing because what I'll say is the environment is everything, folks. The environment has absolutely nothing to do with changing your personality. That's not changeable. But the environment is the only thing that we can change. Because your personality is basically immutable, what it means is that we need to put that little critter in the place where it fits. This is Jen's thing about you got to know what kind of plant you are, so you need to know whether you need to be in the sun or you need to be in the shade. And so that's what you can do in clinical psychology with these those types of problems is you can think through reasonably where to put the plant, and after that, you're pretty well done. There is no great deep work to be done to fix it because there's nothing wrong. It's just a variant. So that's so there will be a gradual major overhaul of the way clinical psychology is conceptualized and done in the next 50 years as the truths of behavior genetics are slowly and inexorably absorbed into the culture. It won't be fast just because it's very distasteful. Okay, people don't, this seems very, very nasty. It seems Nazi-like. It seems, barbaric and rude and disagreeable and terrible. It's none of these things, okay? It's just a realization that we are individuals. And, if you're 5'7", you're 5'7". If you're 6'4", you're 6'4". And there's really nothing we can do about it. And so we put a 5'7 person where a 5'7 person fits, and we put a 6'4 person where a 6'4 person fits. I was just on a submarine, about two weeks ago. Let me tell you something. You don't want to be 6'4 on a submarine.
No, you don't. You want to be about 5'2.
You want to be 5'2. Okay? Don't put the tall soldiers on the submarine. That's just cruel. Yeah. All right? So anyway, that's just some more of our thoughts about that. That's that's such a major part of what goes on in clinical psychology is this nudging around and trying to change people's personalities. That is a waste of time. All of the action is, and the action is very dynamic, very usually very quick and very important and potent solutions to adaptive problems comes when the person is miscalibrated or misinformed about the nature of the competitive processes that they're facing. Normal clinical psychology never speaks of competitive processes. It's not in the playbook anywhere. Okay.
It's actively not. It doesn't matter what other people think of you. It dance like no one's looking. just focus on your own. It's just like you dance like no one's watching, kind of thing. This is very much the opposite perspective.
Yeah, I think that's the most. I think I've said this before. That's the most bizarre little thing that seems so inspiring. That little quote. But the truth is,
like no one's watching.
Yeah. When nobody's around and nobody's watching, I'm dancing as if they're watching. And if they're watching, I'm absolutely worried about what they're thinking.
It's when they're not watching that you're practicing your moves and you're checking in with your internal audience to see what it thinks. That's the whole point.
The whole point is what do they think when I'm dancing? What the hell is the point?
But the peddlers of transformation, this is the equivalent to the good news about bad habits in the dietary world. If you just eat more butter and brie, you're going to lose more weight. Your personality is absolutely, we can transform it if we just heal your past trauma and you're not going to have these problems anymore. Like, who can say no to that? If you've got two therapists to choose from and one of them's, us being all surly over here saying, sorry, there's not much we can do. You got personality cancer. Like, you can try to change your environment, but good luck. And then you've got someone over here saying, well, no, of course you can transform yourself. Like, we just need to understand what happened to traumatize you in your childhood and heal this process and then you can move forward. Like, that is much more attractive and appealing to a lot of different people who are looking to avoid competitive process and to just have an easier go of it. So this is not going to take the world by storm in any hurry, both because it does ring of uncomfortable truths like Dr. Lyle was talking about earlier, but also because the magic bean salespeople are not going anywhere anytime soon with their promises of deep transformation and personality growth.
Epigenetics.
Yeah, and even for the well-meaning, people, it sounds like they're trying to debug a program, understanding that it's a hardware problem.
It's a hardware, yeah.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, right.
And that would be a la cognitive therapy. It's going to be working a lot that direction.
Right.
They're not deep transformational, trauma mongering fools. They're working much more surface level, but they have no recognition of behavior genetics in that field. And they also, incidentally, have no recognition that the core problems that give rise to human struggles and discomfort are competitive. So yeah.
Nobody wants to admit that.
No. And so this is the beauty of integrating biology with psychology where it belongs. Biology is all about competition. And so when we can look that squarely in the eye and we start talking, I mean, that's the first, you know, those are some of the incredible resounding sentences that I read in Dawkins the first time I read Dawkins. It's like, oh my God, like this whole show is about being sexually attractive. It's like, well, of course it is. You talk about talking to my source code, you know, as a 30-year-old, 29-year-old guy, it's like, you bet that's exactly what's on people's minds. And to finally have someone just say so casually and so, you know, so authoritatively from the standpoint of evolutionary biology, it's like, oh my God, how clear and obvious and unapologetic can we get? And you know what? It is the way it is. And therefore, setting sail for trying to improve people's circumstances with respect to their competitive abilities in important domains, that's what I try to do. And that's where the big money is made, the big emotional money is made, is in working that angle rather than working the angle of we're going to cause you to be fundamentally different. That's a waste of time. All right.
Wonderful. Well, it reminds me, I just read a part of an article a couple of days ago that just came out it was a doctoral student out of psychology at Ohio State. It was David Craig and Jennifer Chevens. And it's a 27 study meta-analysis. And it was called Gratitude Interventions, Effective Self-Help. And they tried to study that whether or not gratitude interventions, like, you know, expressing gratitude actually helped the symptoms of depression and anxiety. And they found that it basically had no effect at all, which was contrary to what many people tend to think, is that you have to write a letter thanking somebody or that you have to, you know, engage in these gratitude events and that'll help you with your depression and anxiety.
Right.
And they found that it actually has no effect at all, which is nothing new based on what we've heard from you, Dr. Lyle.
Sure.
But it's another nail in the coffin.
Oh yeah, like what competitive problem was that supposed to help solve? And the answer is no. It's going to have to magical mindset change. Like I don't know what the hell they're thinking, but it's not evolutionary biology. We don't have the aardvark, you know, try to get more gratitude about his or her circumstances to improve their emotional functioning. No, if you're a scared aardvark, find a place where you're less scared. That's what you need to do. The preen a little and try to get laid. Something. Make a change. Make a competitive change. All right. What else do we have, Nathan?
All right. One of our questions, our next question is, dear doctors, how do I overcome fear? I have a friend who is brave and courageous. I would so like to accomplish those qualities, but whether it comes to skydiving, public speaking, or taking other risks, I'm super scared and it takes so much time for me to make the leap. How can I make the leap easier and become more courageous when I know that's what I really want? Are there any tricks, shortcuts, or techniques, or maybe game-changing information regarding this?
Well, it's appropriate we've been discussing personality because this is largely a personality question. So I think there's a big difference between having a specific phobia, like a, you know, a quote unquote irrational phobia of something, and just having kind of a risk averse personality. And it sounds like the way that this question is phrased, it sounds like this is a person who's just a little more risk averse than their friend is, who's a little more, you know, thrill seeking. So this is a bell curve in personality, just like any other. It's gonna map closely, but not perfectly, onto openness. You know, the intersection between openness and conscientiousness, and a couple of other different things. So those forces are going to interact and fight each other a little bit. But some people are thrill seekers, and some people are not. Some people are adrenaline junkies. Some people are not. So if you're not a skydiver and your friend is, that's very much just a question of baseline personality, and you're not going to will yourself into becoming somebody who, you know, jumps out of planes for fun because that's who you would like to be. And that seems like it would be a more effective sexual display to the village and all of the other reasons that you might want to cultivate that kind of public image of yourself. If that's not your personality, it's not your personality. If you've got a specific phobia of something that you, that is like, you know, debilitating and that you would like to overcome. So they mentioned public speaking as well. So that is something that you can improve through the process that we're talking about in the earlier question about the therapeutic process by improving your information. And so in that case, you're improving your information and you're running a more effective cost-benefit analysis on the how risky it is to engage in public speaking by gradually exposing yourself to small little doses of activities that mimic public speaking and then actually putting yourself out there on stage in front of people and basically teaching your nervous system over time, gradually, bit by bit, that this is something that you can do and it's very scary, but you did it and you didn't die. And so as you progressively expose yourself to that kind of input and train your nervous system to some degree, you know, this is a process of exposure therapy. You can move the needle on how comfortable you are with something and how fearful you are of it, but you're not going to fundamentally become a more thrill-seeking, adrenaline junkie kind of individual just because you want to be or because your friend would want to be. So that's the main take on that. But if Dr. Lyle has anything to add, I'm sure he can jump in.
And go to a dynamic therapist.
I'm just curious also, it's interesting that this person equates but skydiving and public speaking is like the same, you know, in the same sentence as the rest of the risks. So
Yeah, that's why I'm inferring that it sounds like just kind of a, this is somebody who's probably very similar to me, which is, you know, you've got a lot of openness in your system and you would like to do a bunch of thrill seeking things, but you also have very high conscientiousness, which vetoes those things. So my life was much more interesting in my 20s when I drank a lot of alcohol because I basically took my conscientiousness offline. So I was much more, I did a lot more thrill seeking adrenaline type activities. And so I guess that's another tip is to just drink more. that's a way you can change your environmental situation to change your cost benefit analysis. Not necessarily one that I would actually recommend, though. But that's another form of distortion, actually. So yeah, if you've got a lot of openness, you're feeling the desire. You're basically perceiving the benefit to your public display and your sexual display by being a really courageous person and how that's going to impress the you know, whoever you might want to impress in the sexual arena. But if the conscientiousness is kicking in and saying, no, that's too risky, we can't do that. And so that's creating some dissonance and frustration. So I understand that battle, but that's going to be a tension that exists in your personality. And if you have specific fears that you want to overcome, the only way to overcome those to some degree is to slowly expose yourself.
Perfect. We also learned something a couple weeks ago on that submarine, Jen, and that's that we learned from the guy that gave us a tour of this thing that
who was very tall, by the way.
He was very tall. I couldn't. That
way too tall for that summary.
Way too tall. He said his seasickness never changes. It doesn't
right.
go away.
Yes. Yeah, it's that like, was interesting. As someone who suffers from seasickness, I was like, oh crap. Like really, this isn't something that I can just like become if I get on a boat every day, I'm gonna eventually get over it. Like, no, I just have the genes to be prone to motion sickness and you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
And so, he was amazing because he was like this 6'3", 6'4" dude who suffered from chronic seasickness every time they surfaced. And so he was puking in a bucket. He had to carry around a bucket with him.
Yeah.
Having a terrible time, but he loved the service and he loved being on the boat. And so he stuck with it. Personality, man.
Man, holy smokes. Yeah. Good. All right. Kind what else like we got? One more.
Yeah, exactly like cilantro, actually. It is. These are all very specific circuits. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take one more.
All right.
Okay. All right. So it's kind of a similar topic. Dear doctors, I love the show. I'm a female in my 50s now, and all my life, when someone's mad or upset with me for any reason, and no matter who has the right to be upset with me, I cannot live with it. I perseverate on it, and I cannot shake things until things are resolved. And even after, sometimes I don't find a release. I'm surprised that at this point in my life, I cannot shake this. For example, at work, I made a mistake, and I'm working to fix the error, but I'm ashamed, and even though I'm moving forward with efforts to fix the problem and grow from it, I cannot rest for weeks. What is this heavy and stressful feeling trying to tell me?
Yeah, this is a hyper-conscientious nutcase.
Yes.
Which I say with great love and affection as a fellow HCNC, as we call this particular personality diagnosis. So you're a very high conscientious human, and you're experiencing a reasonable emotional response to a certain situation. So if you make a mistake at work, you're supposed to feel some degree of anxiety around that because you might lose your job. You've decreased your likelihood of genetic survival because you've put yourself and your well-being and your financial security at risk. So it's appropriate to have a certain amount of anxiety and fear and disruption around that because your nervous system is telling you, hey, you made a mistake. That was potentially really problematic. Let's not make that again. Let's you know, learn from this and adjust course and refrain from making this mistake a second time. So that's the middle of the bell curve for conscientiousness would have that kind of like, whoa, crap, like I really messed that up and that was bad and I'm going to be really careful not to do that again. Someone who's on the flaky end of the bell curve is like, ah, whatever, you know, shit happens. Like I still like easy come, easy go. I'll quit the job and go work at Starbucks next week. It's all good. But you're at the other end of the bell curve. You're at the very highly conscientious point where you're essentially any kind of mistake like that, the feedback is super amplified because you're filtering it through this highly, highly conscientious nervous system that it's taking every little mistake too seriously. It's giving too much weight systematically. You know, Dr. Lyle will use the example of a calculator. So if your brain is a cost-benefit analytic engine that's running these calculations on the next best use of your time and energy based on all the available information and the inputs, it's a calculator that's going to systematically produce the same result. But if the calculator, every time you enter 6, enters 12 instead, it's going to be systematically biased. That number is going to be wrong. It's going to be exaggerated. And so that's what you're doing. You're having an exaggerated, essentially incorrect, distorted response to the same input that someone in the middle of the bell curve would have. And so that's your personality. That's who you are. And so that's why when we're talking about change your environment, you can't change the fact that you're an HCNC and that your calculator says 12 when it should say 6. And so you have to put yourself in situations where you're not working for a disagreeable micromanaging boss who's going to freak out every time you make a mistake and put this kind of pressure on you all the time. You need to be in relationships where you're not being criticized on a regular basis. You need to just create opportunities in your life where you're able to more organically relax and not put yourself under as much pressure as a lot of situations that HCNCs will get themselves into, because highly conscientious people are very attractive employees, especially if they're also agreeable. They're very attractive friends because people can count on them. So they get in these situations where they feel a lot of pressure and people have a lot of expectations of them. And that's actually a really bad scenario for their particular nervous system. So this is who you are. And I would say just tend to yourself as best as you can and give yourself some room to breathe as much as you're able.
Perfect. Wonderful. This is, we've talked about this before. It's a strange, impersonal sort of way to look at people, but to some degree, this is the glasses that I have on now. And the glasses are, look at them as animals. And in the same way you would look at dogs or cats. And so everybody knows I got two cats. One of them that's incredibly stable and extroverted and runs out to the car when I pull up. And I just can't believe she does that. Okay. It's like, she's just way too comfortable. So I've got to really be careful with her because she's not careful enough but for herself. The other one, if she's sitting on my lap and a tiny little sound clicks in the house, she leaps off of it. Okay, that one's named Boo. She happens to be all black, and it's like as if somebody says to her, Boo. Okay, that's why she's named that. It's the she's spooked, okay? And so Boo lives quite a good life, but probably 20 times a day, she gets a little anxiety attack, you know, for a few seconds there, a little spick of anxiety, whereas Annalise doesn't. Annalise can go days without any anxiety. These are individual differences, and it's the precisely
Boo,
what
Boo
we're saying
is the better
here.
Hunter, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Boo's much better.
Annalise is way too comfortable, just saunters around the yard. So the
feast.
Oh, Annalise just comes up just lobbies me for food. That's the only reasonable thing for her to do. But the notion is here, if you're Boo, which this person is, that you need a nice quiet cul-de-sac with exactly as Jen's talking about. You need nice people around, nice relationships, nice quiet situations, you know, live in a place that's not conflicted with where you have to fight for parking places and people might ding your door. This is just, you want to work as effectively as you can to put yourself in very, you know, as minimal as stressful situations as possible. That's what you can do. And changing yourself is something we can't do. And that's one of the great lessons of modern psychology.
There is just one more thing to add to that, because it all sounds, I know it can sound a little fatalistic and like there's, you know, it's a little bit, there's nothing active that people can do there. You know, some people will have some benefit. This is where IQ enters the picture. And we talked about this a little bit last week too. So the awareness of your distortion can give you a lot of peace. And so, you know, if you're an HCNC who can kind of watch yourself, have a little out of body experience, where you can, you learn about behavioral genetics and you know that this is who you are and that you're distorted on the bell curve. You can get to a place through, for lack of a better word, a mindfulness kind of relationship to your own personality where you can observe that you are reacting to certain kinds of things in a way through the filter of your personality. And it's not that you can change it. I don't want to imply that through mindfulness, you can then, you know, have more control over your reactivity. You can't, but you can become aware of when you're hashtag, you know, triggered, and that you're reacting in a way that is irrational and that is likely to cause you unhappiness. And so, even though you can't change it and you can't change the wellspring of emotion that's happening inside of you, having the awareness of the process and that it's coming from a distorted personality perspective can be helpful and can give some space to people who are otherwise looking to, oh, why am I this way? Because I learned it in childhood and I was compensating for my maternal neglect, or I was, you know, whatever story people have come up with to try to describe their personality, which implies that they could therefore transform it. If you can get away with that and just recognize, the calculator just spit out the wrong number again because it's, you know, I typed in 6 and it got it wrong, just like it always does. Over time and through some practice of just watching that process, it can give a little bit of freedom to people who have awareness of it.
Yeah.
All Dr. good, Mahalo, Nathan. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Thank you so much. And we'll look forward to talking to you both next week, where hopefully markets have settled down and the coronavirus is probably a little bit more contained.
Sounds good.
All right, Nathan. Great.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.